This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Travel forward with us, 300 years into the future, to confront the greatest mystery ever to threaten mankind. We are aboard a huge starship called the Enterprise. This is the return of Captain Kirk.
An alien object of unbelievable destructive power is less than 3 days away from this planet.
Mr. Spock.
I offer my services as science officer.
Dr. McCoy. Scotty. And joining them on their mission, Commander Will Decker and Navigator Ilea.
I'm sorry.
That you left Delta 4? Or that you didn't even say goodbye?
Get us back an impulse power. Full reverse.
Wormhole distortion has overloaded the main power systems. Delay that phaser order.
This, then, is the epic journey of the Starship Enterprise, traveling to the outer limits of time and space to challenge a vast, living machine of destruction. The human adventure is just beginning. Star Trek, the motion picture.
A Gene Roddenberry production, a Robert Wise film.
And starting tonight, or today, whenever you're listening, the Place to Be pop feed goes where, well, a lot of people, I guess, have gone before. We're not the first, but we will be the best. Welcome, everyone, to the start of a brand new, I guess special here on Pop Goes the Classics, here on the Place to Be Nation Pop Feed. I am Scott Criscola. Earlier in the year, here on Pop Goes the Classics, we're doing a lot of Pop Goes the Classics right now because we can't do a ton of Pop Goes the Movies because we can't watch any. Hopefully that changes as the fall progresses. Because there's a big one that most of us here at the network are looking forward to in November, myself and my co-host included. So we've done a lot of classic stuff. And of course, if you remember back in late May, early June, we did a Pop Goes the Classic series on the legacy of the guy whose movie I was just talking about, Bond, James Bond. And we did a great five-part legacy series talking about the five big, well, I guess four big actors and then the other two guys. And we thank you for your support. Plenty of download clicks. That was fantastic. So we're going to do another one starting tonight. We are going to tackle another tremendous movie franchise, and pretty much more than just movies. It's a franchise, period. Arguably, with another series that shares the same first word, the greatest sci-fi franchise ever. It probably shares a pedestal with the other one that starts with the same first word. And that, of course, is Star Trek. You know we were going to get to this eventually. We haven't had a new Star Trek movie in 4 years, so we don't know if we'll ever get a new Star Trek movie. We probably will. I'll ask this guy in a minute what he thinks. But after doing the Bond series, and of course we weren't going to do 24 parts, unlike that, here we will do the individual movies because there's only 10 of them. We are going to do the first 10. The JJs will probably do maybe in a separate clump because they're not – well, let me bring my co-host in because he can help me chew this out. He was my co-host on the James Bond Legacy series, and he was amazing, and everyone gave him great kudos here at the network. He is the former co-purveyor of OpenTheFridge.net, and man, is he ready to pull the ripcord. He is my good friend and member of the Place to Be Pop Feed family, Rob Piontek, a.k.a. – Tech.
Thank you very much. Thank you. It's so great to be back. And I told you this off the air, but I hope you know what you're getting into by having me on to discuss these movies.
Yes, I am, actually.
Passionate is not the word.
I know. I as well. Because I must love this franchise enough that I actually bought a second copy of the movies when I really didn't need to. Well, I guess I did need to, and we'll talk about that in a bit. All right, so before we get into our topic, the main topic, do you think we will see another Star Trek movie?
Yes, inevitably. Whether it's a fourth installment of the Chris Pine, Zach Quinto iteration has yet to be seen. There has been some recent rumblings from Chris Pine himself saying he's eager to get back to work on that movie, despite reports from last year saying that his contract negotiations fell out, which essentially kind of killed the thought of a next movie.
Right.
But we'll see. We'll see. There was talk of that long-rumored Quentin Tarantino R-rated Trek movie. We'll see if that ever materializes. There was, like, news about that, like, one day a week for about a month last year, and then suddenly there was nothing. So who's to say? But sometime down the line, you know, we'll get something new. I mean, at the moment, you know, Trek is back on TV in not just one, but soon to be four series, which is unprecedented.
It is. It really is.
We're waiting on Discovery Season 3. Mm-hmm. We're waiting on Picard Season 2. Lower Decks has just started, and Stranger New Worlds is on its way. So Trek is back. Dominating might not be the right word, but it's back home on TV for the time being.
Yeah.
So we'll see.
No, it is. No, it is. You're right. I think it's good now for Trek to now be back in our pop culture nerd consciousness, because the other awesome, incredible franchise that starts with the same word is kind of done for the moment. That, of course, being Star Wars, as the Rise of Skywalker is now come and gone, and the Blu-ray comfortably sits on my shelf, and most of us own it, whether digitally or physically. And now Star Wars is kind of sitting back and kind of chilling out for a little bit, kind of reassessing things. I mean, they may have their own – I mean, that building has its own issues right now. They just lost arguably their most popular Marvel guy. We did see some news today about that. Not that we're going off topic, but, you know, about what the future of Black Panther's second movie will be. Of course, we lost the amazing Chadwick Boseman, who we still wonder whether – I mean, he kind of did what Freddie Mercury did. He just hid it till he couldn't hide it anymore, which is unfortunate, but – he's sadly not with us anymore, and we're not sure what they were going to do with the second Black Panther. It's likely going to be his sister, because she was cool. What do you think of that?
That's the logical jump. There's comic book precedent to have the character of Shuri take over the mantle. So it's definitely a distinct possibility.
Yeah, I mean, I easily can see the beginning of Black Panther 2 being a funeral similar to what they did for Tony at the end of Endgame for T'Challa. They'll obviously do that off. So we really obviously have to do it off screen, duh. And so we'll see. But anyway, that's another topic for another day. All right. So when I told Tech that we were going to, this was his and my next venture, as you can hear from the tone of his voice, the eyes glistened over and said, "Ah." and because he knew this was what we talked about at Billion. We knew this after the Bond. We knew this was next. So there's no doubt about it. Because again, Trek is in our consciousness now. We have four shows. We have Discovery, which is pretty awesome in its first two seasons. It's got its criticisms from some, but I still think the show is great. We have Picard, which I will admit at times I was kind of confused, but it is him, and he's awesome. So I let it go that the first couple episodes I was a little lost. I'm not going to lie. Him and I talked about this a lot. But it kind of – the knots in my head unsnarled, and I kind of really enjoyed it towards the end. Because I got to see my man Frakes in The Shift, so that's pretty cool. Frakes in the Lean. I got to see Riker's Lean again. We're not talking about that crew tonight, by the way. We'll get to them later on down the line. Lower Decks is frigging hysterical. And I'll tell you why I like Lower Decks. Because I feel like, unlike Trek, Wars won't laugh at itself. Like, it takes other people to do it for them. Like, yes, we have the crew. Like, Trek, I think, would embrace a shitty holiday special, whereas the other side of the hallway, they hide it under the fucking bed and we never get to see it. Or if we do, we got to find it on YouTube, and then they yanked it. But fortunately, it's on – is it on Plus? No, they didn't.
No. Oh,
they?
God, no.
No, they didn't. But I think Trek has made fun of its not great stuff. And you know what? To hell with it. But Lower Decks is that. It's fantastic. Fantastic. And I'm looking forward to the Pike show.
Yes, yeah, absolutely.
Yes. So tonight is part one of our 10-part journey that we will take through the original Star Trek film series, from the one we're doing tonight all the way to 2002. I know we do have to do that one as well. we may enjoy it by then. Who knows? Before we get to our movie tonight, and that's why this episode will probably be slightly longer than the others, because we obviously have to talk about the history of the franchise. We can't just dive into the movie, because we have to get you there. And it all starts with the dream of a guy who loved outer space. And we're going to mention this guy's name often through the first 5.5 episodes of the series. We're, of course, talking about the founder himself, Mr. Gene Roddenberry.
The great bird of the galaxy.
The great bird of the galaxy. And he came up with this concept for a science fiction television show about a crew on a ship exploring. Open-ended. Now, before that, science fiction was either really weird with crazy looking villains like Plan 9 from Outer Space. And I mean, you had War of the Worlds, which was kind of the first one, but that was radio. And then you had, you had various, sci-fi alien movies in the 50s and 60s, kind of pulp movies.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you've got your some would say the holy trinity of the Day the Earth Stood Still. Yep. Forbidden Planet. Yep. And like The Thing from Another World.
The Thing from Another World. Correct.
Yeah.
And other movies, kind of The Blob and some other weird sci-fi-ish movies. As for TV, I mean, pretty much you had My Favorite Martian, Bill Bixby and Ray Walston, comedy. Lost in Space, sort of serious, but kind of not. Very tongue-in-cheek-ish.
Everything had silver jumpsuits. That pretty much just is the common denominator of 1950s science fiction.
Exactly.
That's what we were going to be wearing in the future.
Exactly. All the outfits were made of tinfoil. Yeah. So we were all wearing weird hats with funny antennae. And all the aliens were green and had no arms. So, and if they did, they were very short. Gene Roddenberry didn't want to do that. He wanted to do a serious, I mean, lighthearted, but not comical sci-fi series. So yeah,
he described his original pitch as Wagon Train to the Stars. You know, take that Western style TV show and set it on a spaceship, and that was the seed right there.
Yep. Let me get the date officially. On September 8th, 1966, on NBC was the first episode of Star Trek.
As we record this, that anniversary is 2 days away.
2 days away. Yes, it is. 2 days away from the 54th anniversary. 54 years since the first episode of Star Trek.
The Man Trap.
The Man Trap. That is
the first episode to air, the third episode to be produced.
that's a mess in its own way. The show was almost canceled multiple times. But it would last 3 seasons, 79 episodes. Now we could talk about the show for hours and hours, and maybe that's a fun show. Topic. Yeah. That's a fun topic for a future, maybe podcast series here on the Place to Be Pop Feed. When did you first watch what we call TOS, TOS, and what did you love about it the minute you watched it?
I'll put this right out there at the beginning. I have not seen a whole lot of the original series.
Really?
Now I know this is odd considering how much of a card carrying Trekkie that I am, but I didn't see sit down to actually watch any original series episodes until fairly recently, to be honest. Like I had seen stuff in the past. You know, the big ones, Trouble with Tribbles, City on the Edge of Forever, like landmark episodes that, a lot of people cite as pure Trek. But in terms of the whole series, I was ready to sit down and watch the whole thing in 2016 for the 50th anniversary. And I got as far as Balance of Terror. which is, I think, about 10 or 12 episodes into the first season. And something happened. I got distracted and I didn't continue. So sadly, that's where that stands. My true introduction, though, was the original cast movies. That was okay. Where my love affair with Star Trek began, because they had the V8, you know, I was probably 8 or 9 years old. They had VHS tapes to take out at the local library. And for some reason, I still to this day don't know why, I would take them out in pairs, but in very strange pairs. I would take out 4 and 6 together. I would take out 2 and 3 together, and 1 and 5. Because at the time, that's all there were. We had Generations hadn't come out yet. And that was how I got to know Kirk and Spock and Bones and the cast, the crew of the Enterprise, was through those movies. So even watching Wrath, not to jump ahead to next episode, but watching Wrath of Khan, you know, I had no context, you know, seeing as that movie is based on an episode, I had no context, but it's, again, this is a discussion for that episode. It's so well done that you didn't really need it. You get the idea of what the lead in is, but yeah, that's sadly where my, I'm a Star Trek fan by way of the movies as an introduction.
I'll be honest. I am as well. I'm a little older than you, but I love the movies, and that's why we're doing a series. Duh. But my dad loved the original series. My dad loved Next Gen. My dad loved Next Gen. Loved it. I was not a fan in the beginning. We'll get more into this when we get to Generations, because that's where the term kind of fits the debate. But I love these movies. I love this movie tonight, actually. And I know a lot of people are weird about it, but that's why I'm looking forward to doing this one tonight, because to start the series, because I still think this one can be debated. Some love it, some hate it. But we'll get to that in a second. So in 1969, the series ended. And the franchise would continue 4 years later with one of my favorite things that I ever loved to watch. I don't own it. I do own the original series on Blu-ray. The Blu-ray collection is amazing. So you have to get it. It's the silver boxed ones that came out, 11 years ago, I think. Tremendous set, by the way. I know they're on Netflix, but as a collector like me, they look pretty good on your shelf. Although they are in air date order, which pisses me off. I kind of need you as my cheat sheet to try to watch
them in production order.
Yeah,
so you're not suddenly seeing Uhura in a gold uniform and wondering what the hell.
Exactly. When did that promotion happen?
Yeah.
As a matter of fact, I think one of the past formats, it might have been one of the VHSs, were in star date order.
Which is more confusing.
Which I know it is more confusing, really. So, but in 1973, we had Star Trek, the animated series, which was 22 episodes and ran from September 8th. Wow. How about that? Symmetry. September 8th, 1973 to October 12th, 1974.
How about
and
that?
A lot of people call that the fourth season of the original series, just animated instead of the actual people. And all of the actors, sans Walter Koenig, voiced it. And to this day, we still don't know why he wasn't on. I don't know. Do you have any inkling? I don't.
I probably was told at one point, but I don't remember. It's funny, though, because he ended up writing an episode. So he did get his name in there in some form.
What's funny about Walter Koenig is, and I'm really going down the nerd rabbit hole here, he didn't do Star Trek, the animated series. However, in this same time frame, he did three episodes of The Star Lost, which was a tremendous, totally cheese down the cheese Canadian sci-fi series with Cara Delay of 2001 A Space Odyssey fame. Actually, there's a lot of guys in that. Sterling Hayden, who, for those that don't know, played McCluskey, the corrupt captain who took a bullet in the head from Michael Corleone in The First Godfather. A couple other actors too, but Walter Koenig was a bad guy on three episodes of The Star Lost, right around the time that the animated series was going on. So maybe he signed a deal and couldn't cross the line. I mean, who knows how?
Maybe it's just been scheduling, you know?
Yeah, I mean, who knows?
Shooting how that one couldn't record the other.
Exactly, and it really said. But anyway, the animated series, all the actors were back, and They did two. It's two seasons, but it was 22 episodes, half hour episodes. Then we had a void of Trek. We had books. There were novels that were written starting in, I think, like 75 or 76. There were some standalone novels. But for the most part, Star Trek kind of left our consciousness for a while.
I mean, it had its legs in syndication. That was huge. I forget who it was. Somebody said, like, all the kids who weren't able to stay up and watch it when it was airing normally in syndication in a different time slot, they were able to see it then. And that was where it started to build its younger audience.
Mm-hmm.
So it had legs.
Yeah, it did. It did. And from that, we get discussions about the possibility of a new show. And that's where we get to tonight. So let us officially open up the vault. Tonight, on part one of our 10-part series on the greatness and legacy of the Star Trek motion picture franchise, we have Star Trek the Motion Picture, which came out on December 7th, Pearl Harbor Day, 1979. So right around this time, in the late 70s, discussions opened about the possibility of a new series. The rumor was that it was going to be called, sir,
Star Trek Phase Two. And it would be the launch show for the Paramount Television Service, a whole new TV channel for Paramount.
Yep.
And what's funny about that is while it didn't end up doing that, obviously because there was no show, but there also was no network. Fast forward to 1995, Star Trek Voyager would be the launch show for the UPN, the United Paramount Network, which was finally that network materialized. And then skip ahead again to when Star Trek Discovery launches CBS All Access.
Right, exactly.
So a precedent was set, to be sure.
Yeah, no, it's pretty funny. Unfortunately, and there was a lot of people that were throwing their name in to write episodes. Ray Bradbury, Theodore Sturgeon, Harlan Ellison, who actually wrote Star Lost. But something happened. The things got unwielding. And instead of doing that, instead of doing the series, they decided they would take the first episode of the series and make it into a motion picture. The reason they thought that was at the same time that Space Shuttle Enterprise launched, Close Encounters of the Third Kind came out, and then of course Star Wars came out.
Oh yeah, so absolutely. You have Star Wars come out, you know, and just changes everything, quite literally.
Yep, literally.
And then over at Paramount, you've got Michael Eisner, who would, of course, go on to become the head of the Disney Corporation. Mm-hmm. He's there. I'm pretty sure it was president of Paramount, or a very high position of power. And they're pitching Star Trek Phase Two. They're talking about scripts and everything, and they have the script for what you said was going to be the pilot. Mm-hmm. At that time called In Thy Image, I believe. And Eisner was pretty much the one to say, we have been looking to make a Star Trek movie, and this is the script we're going to use. So it was the script for the pilot that convinced him to say, we can make this movie, because, you know, they're sitting there going, you know, Star Wars comes out, they go, well, what do we got? Do we got anything like this? And somebody puts up their hand and go, we got Star Trek?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, a legit franchise. Mm-hmm. So on November 11th, 1977, 2.5 weeks before Phase 2's production was due to start, Paramount said, to hell with that idea. Gone was the whole thing about a network and all that other jazz. No TV series. We're making a movie, folks!
Yep.
So on March 28th, this is an amazing fact, by the way. On March 28th, 1978, Paramount assembled the largest press conference held at the studio since Cecil B. DeMille announced he was making the Ten Commandments. Pretty cool. Another great movie that I actually own. Robert Wise would direct. We'll get to that in a second. So the premise of the movie is a, I guess it's supposed to be a strange alien entity hidden in a cloud of energy, loaded with electricity, is going through space and is going to hit Earth and blow it up. I mean, that's a simple way of saying it. And that was kind of what the first episode I was slated to be. I don't know how they would have fit that in 44 minutes, but in any event.
Yeah. Oh, the script is definitely padded in terms of what it had. Yeah. They had a treatment for, you know, an episode about, well, we got to go back to the original series. There's an episode of the original series called The Changeling, season 2, episode 3, which is about a mechanical probe that gains sentience, is taken aboard the Enterprise. And it's like, oh, you know, what's my purpose? You know, wants to meet its creator and all this. Jump ahead to this pilot in Thy Image. It's the exact same plot. It's this entity from beyond that turns out is looking for its creator. Turns out it's from Earth. Spoiler alert. And then they changed the title one more time. It called it Robots Return. And that was going to be an episode of another show Gene Roddenberry was going to do in 1973 called Genesis 2. That mm-hmm. didn't get beyond the pilot phase. There's only like a TV movie about it. But yeah, so this is a script that had, this is a story idea that had existed since, you know, 1967 that just kind of got turned around a few times. And that's what they landed on. So they're kind of retreading material, and obviously it had been done in, you know, 44 minutes on the original series, and as we see in the movie, they definitely stretched it out
very much so.
We'll
get to that in a second. So they decide to bring back of course the original cast, and let's talk about them now, and we'll start from the bottom and work our way, well, not from the bottom, we'll start from the lowest office and work our way up. So we of course bring back George Takei is Sulu.
Takei.
Why do I always do that?
It's okay to be Takei.
I always do that. George Takei is, of course, Sulu. Nichelle Nichols is back as Uhura. Walter Koenig, we just mentioned him, came back as, of course, Pavel Chekhov, or as someone would say, almost 10 years later, the guy who played Chekhov.
Yeah.
We'll get to that joke in a few episodes.
Oh, yeah.
Of course, James Doohan came back as the awesome chief engineer, Montgomery Scott.
This time sporting a sweet mustache.
Oh, yeah. He had a delicious mustache. Yes. And then, of course, the big three. DeForest Kelly is back in his awesome leisure suit and giant medallion.
Oh, dear Lord. And that beard.
And that beard. As, of course, medical officer Leonard Bones McCoy. Looking like he just left his flat in Malibu with his hookers and blow, and pretty much look like.
Holy hell, it is a sight to behold.
It is ridiculous, absolutely ridiculous. And now, of course, the big two. Leonard Nimoy would return as Mr. Spock. A lot of people thought he would not come back. Everybody thought Leonard was high maintenance. I never really thought that, but
He wasn't going to. When it was going to be phase two, a new series, he wasn't going to come back. And they wrote a new character named Zahn, another Vulcan, full Vulcan this time. Mm-hmm. And he was the Spock replacement. He was an actor, David Gautreau, I believe is how you say it. He was cast. And, you know, there's photos, there's screen test of the guy in costume and makeup and everything. And as a consolation prize, he actually shows up in this movie as the Epsilon 9 commander Branch. So
yep.
That was he was going to be our new Spock until they convinced Leonard to come back.
Yes. And he did, thank God. And of course, how could we forget this gentleman last? Coming back to be my favorite captain ever, James Tiberius Kirk, the Shat himself, William Shatner, who had spent most of the 70s kind of bouncing around movies. He did one of the spider movies, one of the really bad horror movies with spiders. I'll have to look it up, but he did a horror movie involving killer spiders. he, you know, probably did some TV, bounced back and forth, maybe did a, showed up on, you know, various television cop shows of the 70s.
Oh, absolutely. If there was a TV show on in the 70s, Shatner was most likely in an episode or two.
And let's see, I got to find his filmography.
Kingdom of the Spiders, 1977.
Yes, he was a he was like a botanist or something. And he's in this little town and these alien spiders grow and they're it was utterly ridiculous. So while he was in between, he was doing a ton of films: Kingdom of the Spiders, The Devil's Reign, Big Bad Mama, Impulse. I'm sure they were all, you know, in his eyes, you know, Oscar winners. On television during that stretch, he was in 4 episodes of Ironside.
Mm-hmm.
He was in 2 episodes of both Owen Marshall, Counselor at Law, and Mission Impossible. He was in the television version of The Hound of the Baskervilles. He was in an episode of Hawaii 5-0. He was in an episode of the TV series of The Sixth Sense. Did come back and voice Kirk in the animated series. He was on an episode of Barnaby Jones, Mannix. Oh, this is tremendous. $6 Million Man, Kung Fu, Columbo. Oh my God, he really filled the ledger of the 70s. Good grief. So there you go. So he was doing the Shat was doing a ton of stuff. Of course, Leonard. And I'm looking at I have this show as a DVD set. He, of course, did. And he actually did it the tail end of this show while he was shooting this. He was, of course, the host of In Search Of, which is kind of like Unsolved Mysteries, but creepier and without any murders. It's mostly, you know, strange civilizations, ghosts, UFOs, that kind of thing. But it was a great show. I loved it as a kid. And he did one of my favorite sci-fi horror remakes of all time, the 1978 version of Close Encounter. Not Close Encounter, I'm sorry. Invasion of the Body Snatchers.
Mm-hmm.
He did the remake with Donald Sutherland and Brooke Adams and who the fuck else was in that? There was somebody else in that too. And him. Jeff Goldblum actually is in it. A very young Jeff Goldblum is in that. Of course, the original 1956 with Kevin McCarthy, who's in the movie, by the way, for like 3 seconds or something. So they've been busy. I don't know what Bones was doing during that stretch. He was probably doing shows too. So they're all back together. In the story, after the 5 years were up, Kirk was promoted to Admiral, while a new Enterprise was being fitted, I guess you could say.
Yeah, refit. It's the original Enterprise, but it's just, yeah, they gave her a facelift. New engines, new exterior, new deflector dish, all that good stuff. Which is a fun way of saying they built a brand new model for the big screen.
Exactly, yes. the legendary and awesome olive-colored Enterprise from the show needed to be kind of sexed up a little bit for the movie. And we get some new characters, main characters. A very young and relatively unknown Stephen Collins plays Will Deckard, who was going to be the captain of the Enterprise, but somebody's ego couldn't handle it. And Persis Kambada, who I would see in a great horror movie. Well, not really a horror movie, more of a low-budget action film later in the decade of the 80s. Sadly, she passed away in the late 90s, very young. She would play Ilia, the Delton navigator of the Enterprise. She was Delton. She was supposed to be in the movie, in the TV show.
Yeah, they both were.
Both
the characters were.
Yeah, so. All right, so.
They were the younger officers to, you know, appeal to a new audience.
New audience, right. Correct.
Yeah.
We're not going to go through the whole movie, you know, shot for shot. But in essence, what happens is this alien presence goes through space, tears up 3 Klingon Klingon birds. By the way, also refitted and looking pretty damn awesome, but they look like a bunch of more. It was like the only time that Klingons look like complete idiots because they're just kind of like staring off and then they get killed.
Yeah. The big debut of the new, the Klingons that everybody knows with the bumpy foreheads and the facial hair and everything, which of course would go on to be the norm and, you know, tickle the brains of thousands and thousands of Trek fans for ages, wondering how they went from looking one way in the original series to looking like that.
Exactly. Yes. It was the first time that they had to make them very much more alien looking.
Yeah.
Then they rip through a science station. And so this energy thing is heading to Earth. So the Enterprise, who's the only ship that can go out because it's the closest one.
As usual.
As usual. Not done yet.
We're the only ship in range, sir.
We're the only ship in range, sir. So Admiral Kirk goes on the ship, tells Deckard, take a seat, sunshine. Guess who's here? And Kirk takes over as captain, and the rest of the movie goes on, and we find out that V'ger is actually Voyager, as in the U.S. ship from the 60s. And this presence came, and accruing information about history and such. So, what are your overall thoughts? Now, the way we're going to do this from here on out for the 10 movies is we're going to do 5 categories and grade it on a scale of 1 to 10. Then we're going to add it up and have a final score. And that way, when we get to, when we conclude Star Trek Nemesis, 9 episodes from now, we'll have our composite list and rank all 10 films. So we're going to do 5 categories. Plot, cast performance, villains, music, and production value. Meaning like sets, locations, shots, pretty colors, that kind of thing. So point number one, category number one, plot. I know I was a little rough on it. Feel free to fill the holes. I appreciate that. Did you like the plot? Now, this is one of the longest. I don't think they expected the movie to be this long, 2 hours and 12 minutes. And that includes the director's cut, I think, is that long, too. It might be a little longer, like 5 minutes, I think. What are your thoughts on the plot? And was the plot what hurt the movie?
No, the plot is not what hurts the movie. The pacing and the special effects folks giving themselves a pat on the back is what hurts the movie. The plot is relatively simple. As we discussed earlier, you know, it was adapted from an earlier story that we had already covered, you know, very simple. Alien creature turns out to be from Earth, you know, gains sentience looking for its creator. Pretty straightforward. Kind of thought-provoking when you think about it. And they really got close to making it really, really, you know, thought-provoking again. Sorry to repeat myself. But because they tie in Spock and to the whole story about V'ger and all this and how he's, when we meet Spock at the beginning of this movie, he's back home. He's trying to purge himself of all emotion, you know, because that was the whole thing with the character in the series is he's half human, half Vulcan, you know, emotional human, logical Vulcan, you know, two sides of this, of, you know, his personality vying with each other. So here he is trying to purge himself of this unwanted human side. And this creature, this intelligence reaches out to him and he has this kindred connection with it, that it too is looking for, you know, it holds the answers that he's looking for about logic and purging emotion. And it's through the encounter with this is, in my opinion, the best part of the movie is the whole Spock subplot, because the scene where he goes out, he puts himself before the crew, you know, and the ship when he goes out and he attempts to, you know, make contact with V'ger, whoever V'ger is at this point, nobody still knows. And he, you know, attempts to mind meld with the central intelligence, and it just blows his mind, literally. And he learns that V'ger is just cold logic, and that it, like what he is trying to do, is completely devoid of any kind of emotion, humanity. And it's my favorite scene in the whole movie is after this, he's in sick bay, he's kind of half out of it, and he wakes up, he realizes this, to the point where Leonard, you know, chuckles. You know, Spock, who doesn't smile, doesn't laugh, who doesn't emote, has this moment where he's just so overwhelmed with what he's dealing with, what he's discovered. And he tries to explain to Kirk, you know, this creature that we're dealing with has no emotion, it's just pure cold logic. And he puts his hand up to make Kirk take his hand, and he clasps his hand, and he just refers to this one action. He goes, this simple feeling is beyond V'ger's comprehension. And why it's so great is it encompasses what he has discovered, and B, that moment is essentially predicated on everything that came before, the 3 years of the TV series, knowing who Kirk and Spock were, that anyone watching can just see that a simple joining of the hands of two very close friends is a very strong emotion. There's a bond there. There's a familial bond. And for him to just say this simple feeling, doesn't have to spell it out. It's visual, and he just, you know, they feel it, and you as the viewer see it and feel it. Oh, it's wonderful. It's one of my, it's my absolute favorite moment in the movie. And but in terms of the rest of the story, you know, it's just about, it's very Star Trek. It's them going out, you know, facing off against an alien threat, you know, that is one hell of a threat when you see, you know, the scope of what they're dealing with towards the end of the movie. And in a very Star Trek way, they discover what the truth is. They address it in a way that no one saw coming. And they send this mm-hmm. new life form on its way. And that's, you know, goes back to the opening in the narration, you know, to seek out new life and new civilizations. So at its core, the story is very Star Trek. But I get, you know, I'm about to contradict myself. That is kind of what I guess did undo the audience reaction to the story, is you took this story that did work well on TV, and you adapted it to a movie. And in order to do that, you had to stretch it out. No, I guess that's not really the plot's fault. It's how the rest of the movie is paced and told and shot that. But we'll go into that. But yeah, that's my take on the plot.
I liked it, and I thought it was very. And I think this is one of the criticisms that we hear, and this is kind of why Roddenberry, who obviously was very hands on, would no longer be hands on from here on out. It was a great plot that probably would have been fine in a TV episode, and could have been told compactly in a compact fashion. And they did kind of need to fill the holes to make this a movie length. I've heard people say this is the most Star Trek of all the Star Trek movies because it's going out and exploring some unknown thing. Yeah, that's fine. Unfortunately, a lot of those plots fit nicely in 44 minutes. Some of them don't fit in 2 hours and 12 minutes.
Yeah.
So, you know, you can't, it's nice to have a show that Roddenberry thought would have that TV feel, but we don't have a TV feel. This is a big screen, not a little one. And I think that's where a lot of the problems set in, is that they took a TV script and stretched it rather than, I don't want to say scrapping it, but maybe starting from scratch.
Yeah. Gene was a TV writer. That was his bread and butter for years and years and years. And, you know, they come to him to adapt to the big screen, and he was still stuck in his TV mindset in terms of writing and how to tell the story. And it just fell a little short in terms of making the leap.
Yeah, exactly. All right. So on 1 to 10, what do you give the plot?
I give the plot an 8.
Okay.
Yeah.
And you could do half C's, by the way, too.
Yeah. Well, I'll give it a solid 8. Again, it's a little bit compelling. They make good use of it at times. Yeah, it's a very Star Trek plot.
It is. Okay, cast performance. That's our next category. They might have been a little rusty. You know, again, Bones fortunately shaved, a.k.a., you know, took the glue off whatever the hell was hanging on his face. It looked worse than, what's his name's beard, in Star Wars, you know.
Oh, General Nadine?
General Nadine and his, whatever his dead animal he had on his face. His
fake beard, yeah.
Oh, it's awful. Anyway, for the most part, the dialogue was fine. Everybody seemed to be fine. Here's my problem, and I said this to you after I watched it again. Jim Kirk is a hero. That's always been the way it is. He kind of goes by the beat of his own drummer, and we'll talk a lot about that over the next 5 movies. But he was, for lack of a better term, kind of a dick in this movie.
I have almost that exact note.
Yeah, I mean, like, he comes in here, I'm an admiral. I'm the tits. I'm the big shot. And he tells poor Will, yeah, you did a great job. Thanks for rebuilding the ship. I'm flying it now. Go sit over there, little kid. And it's like, who the fuck are you? You know, it's like, you're the one who's been, you know, sitting behind a desk for the last, whatever, 7 years or whatever. Where do you get off walking in here? This was your ship. And I always thought they could have done a better. I mean, I understand that throughout most of these six movies he's in, the frustration is always he's just getting older. And we always every movie with him in it from here till six always kind of has that underlying you're getting old. And I get that, but do you go right out of the gate of the first movie and have him come off as such a douche? I don't know. I've always questioned that. What do you think?
It's you're absolutely right. I have the known from me Kirk kind of a jerk.
Yeah, pretty much.
But yeah, he's the second he steps off that shuttlecraft at the beginning of the movie, he's just got this, you know, puss on his face where he's like, you know, irritated to be doing anything. You know, the first lines out of his mouth are, you know, like, I'm on my way to the Enterprise. You know, don't talk to me. You know, this is very important business. You know, I think it was their way of saying that Kirk had been promoted. He'd been an admiral post, you know, original series. And he just wasn't happy about it. Like, this is a guy who's, as he said himself, his first great love is the Enterprise. You know, he wants to be out there commanding a starship, exploring, you know, betting a few alien chicks, you know.
Yep. Which, yes.
Exactly. So the story begins with him doing his damnedest to get back to that. And he doesn't care who he steps on the way up there. Decker being, you know, the first person he, you know, plants his foot on. You know, he gets on board and Decker's like, oh, welcome aboard. You know, I didn't know we were getting a top brass send off. He's like, I'm taking command. What? And it just goes from there. And you have this, not a foil, but Decker and Kirk, it starts off as this antagonistic relationship, which is cool. You know, it's good to see something like that, you know, to kind of get you invested in these characters. But they play it off as kind of a father-son relationship. So again, this is a relic or an artifact of Phase 2. Since Spock wasn't going to be there, they were going to kind of redirect Kirk's relationship towards this new guy. So instead of like the Kirk-Spock, you know, friend dynamic, we're going to have this father-son dynamic. So we have this kind of existing alongside the Spock dynamic as he shows up. But yeah, he shows up. He's all blustery and everything. But what's cool about it is as the story plays out, this is kind of going back to the plot, the characters that he had been apart from, as they come back into his life, they bring him back down. McCoy especially, because as soon as McCoy comes aboard, yes, he's irascible and bitching about everything like he does.
Right.
There's this great scene on the bridge where Kirk is, you know, they have the whole warp accident thing where they screw up and the wormhole and all that, blah, 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 blah. And he's like, you know, we need warp speed. You know, Scotty, get on this, whatever. And Bones literally standing behind him comes down and taps him on the shoulder and says, Jim, you're pushing. Your people know their jobs. And you kind of see Kirk look at him and quietly say, oh, shit, he's right. And it's great. You know, you start to see Kirk start to get reined in, essentially. Mm-hmm. And yeah. Then it occurs later when he chews out Decker, you know, about like, why'd you, you know, belay my order about, you know, phasers and everything. He's like, sir, you know, the system doesn't work the way it used to. You don't know this ship a tenth of the way I do, you know. And then again, Kirk acknowledges, like, you're right. You do know this ship better than I do, which I'm sure was a hard pill for him to swallow.
Yep.
But he acknowledges. He goes, the line is, you know, perhaps you'll nursemaid me through this. He goes, yes, sir, I'll do that. And so it's good to see Kirk grow. You actually see an arc in the character in this one movie. Like you say, he shows up blustery and everything. And as he interacts with this crew, his family, the characters that quite literally defined him over the course mm-hmm. of the series.
Absolutely.
You see him get back to where he was. Mm-hmm. And I think that's really good writing.
It is. It is. And I think kind of settling into this new norm of a wider scope, a wider stage than the TV show where he could be him and it's a small, this is a bit more for him and the rest of the cast. So mm-hmm. everybody fits their spot. Everybody settles in and you feel like, all right, I'm back where I feel like where I was, you know, 13 years ago.
Absolutely. And they actually forgot to mention, there's actually one moment in the movie where it's telegraphed, essentially, after everybody's there, after Kirk Spock shows up, after they fix the warp engines and everything's back to 100%, they hit warp speed. And, you know, it's this big celebratory moment like, yeah, we did it. Music flourishes. And Kirk winks at Sulu. And that's the moment where it's like, Kirk is back. We are back to, you know, original series Kirk. It's they put a button on it right there.
Yep.
The complete.
They absolutely do. So, yeah. So the cast overall, and I thought Stephen Collins was great, future controversies aside. Yeah. And Persis Combato was great. It was disappointing because he was great on Seventh Heaven, too. They do the whole melding at the end. They were in love. He bolted. Typical Starfleet officer relationship. And then they merge and become one because V'ger actually overtakes her body, which is kind of creepy. But but Persis Combato was hot, so even without the hair. So it kind of fit.
And I will say the other performance I want to point out is Leonard Nimoy, because
yes, of course.
this movie is what I and I think a lot of people like to refer to as the beginning of Spock 2.0, because the Spock in the series, again, is the alien, you know. Yes, Captain, that's logical, you know, fighting with his human half, you know, really kind of rigid, you know, he could even be a jerk at times, not often, but occasionally. And that's the Spock that kind of shows up in this movie. And as soon as he has that interaction with V'ger that I talked about before, and he has that moment with Jim, it starts Spock 2.0, where he has accepted his human side, his emotions. He has the line, logic and knowledge are not enough. And, yep. You know, he has the moment where he has the single tear where he weeps for V'ger because he knows that V'ger can never... You know, Spock has the leg up in that thing where he was able to tap into his human side, where and he feels bad that V'ger can't do that because he realizes that is part of life. So, and that's the Spock that carries on through the next movie. We'll get to that, but yeah, mm-hmm. Leonard kills it with all of that, and of course, then there's everybody else. You know, Dr. McCoy is pretty much. Not this isn't a bad thing, but he's a one note character, but it's the one note that everybody loves. Just the irascible, you know, angel on Jim's shoulder, whereas Spock could be considered the devil, you know, how that trifecta works and everything. And then, of course, you know, you have Scotty and Uhura and Sulu and Chekov, who are there and they are all featured. But much like on the show, they do their jobs and that's really about it. So, you know, they don't really get featured the way the big three do.
No, they don't. But I agree with you about the Spock 2.0 because, again, this is a larger canvas to paint on than 44 minutes. Yes, I understand like a season, a TV season is different than a movie because the plots always change. Even though Spock is an integral character, of course, of the show, not every episode's about him. So Spock needs to be a little deeper, if that's even possible, than the TV Spock. Same thing with Kirk. Same thing with all of them. And when we get to our next week's or our next episode, Bones kind of goes down that similar path. So grade the cast performance.
A 9. Yeah, okay. I give it a 9. Like, you know, nothing's perfect.
Right.
But they, like I said, I love the Kirk arc. I love Shatner's performance in this movie. How he starts and how he finishes. I love Leonard. I love DeForest. And yeah, I guess the point comes off because, you know, you have the rest of your cast, you know, the four supporting actors and, you know, not to call them set dressing. I never want to belittle their presence, but,
correct.
You know, Uhura sits there and says, you know, message from Starfleet captain. You know, and Scotty yells about something that's going on in the engine room. So, but yeah, overall, even though it's a sterile movie, you know, these people shine. They absolutely shine.
Yeah. And they did. And they just get better. All right. Next category, villain. I guess this one's hard to grade for this one because it's inanimate.
Yeah, but it one could argue that it's a compelling villain because it's the unseen villain, kind of, because while you have the cloud and you see the giant spaceship and everything, and halfway through the movie you start hearing the name V'ger, it's got this air of mystery to it. Like, who is V'ger? You know, you don't see this person. You know, is it a human? Is it an alien? You know, whatever. So how they tease it is actually pretty cool.
Yes. No, they do. They do. Obviously, it's not like a person. We'll have actual villains down the line.
Yeah.
With varying degrees of success. So what would you grade V'ger at? 6?
Well, I mean, when you finally figure out what it is, it's, I wouldn't even use the term villain. It's just kind of this looming threat, because the character, for lack of a better term, seeing as it's just this essentially an AI, it's out for one thing, and that's to fulfill its programming. You know, the Voyager space probe was launched in 1977 with the directive, you know, gather knowledge and report it back. So they took that, ran with it, and they said, what if this thing gathered so much knowledge that it, you know, gained sentience? And that's the story we have. And it comes back, it has everything. It has the wealth of the universe in its memory banks, and it's like, hey, I'm here to download. And of course, 400 years later, nobody's waiting to hear back. You know, to the point where V'ger transmits with radio, and everybody's like, "What the hell?" You know.
Yeah.
So,
right?
It's hardly a threat, even in that regard. But you know, of course, when it's launching giant plasma energy balls that are about to decimate the surface of the planet, yeah, then you have our attention. So I guess when you stack it up against what would come later, to be certain, it's a pretty weak villain. I wouldn't even give it a 6. I'd probably give it like a 4.
A 4, okay. Yeah. Well, we know that we'll have ones higher than that down the line.
Oh, hell yeah.
next category, production value. Now, this encompasses the sets, the camera, visuals, everything involving the actual meat and potatoes. For me, this is one of the, for lack of a better term, prettiest Star Trek movies. It's beautiful. It's big in scope. When Enterprise is flying into V'ger, it's like freaking gigantic. I mean, they did, you could tell this was the part of the movie that Roddenberry was, you know, popping a chubby over, that he could have this giant, oh my God, look at this set. I can have these giant things that a little TV couldn't. And I can have these long and preparatory moments, and we could really build to when we see V'ger and build when the Enterprise, and we spent 18 minutes doing nothing. 3 lines in 18 minutes. 3 lines. Some music. A lot of flashing. Not much else. Gene, half the crew's asleep. the scene itself is awesome. First of all, let's talk about we'll get to that part too, but the Enterprise itself is a mess. The bridge is bigger than the TV show. Like, the bridge looks like you're in a silo on the TV show because it's so small and cylindrical. Still cold. But the new Enterprise on the outside, very different. The boosters are not circle, you know, they're not tubes anymore. They're like that, what are they, like triangles or?
Yeah, they're more rectangular.
Rectangular, I guess. The ship is white, much whiter. Obviously, as I goofed earlier, you know, the Enterprise, based on your models, every time I look at your ships at your desk, I always think the original Enterprise looked olive. Well, not the original Enterprise. That was like chrome, you know, the Archer Enterprise. But Enterprise, Kirk's Enterprise was like olive, you know. So the new Enterprise looks beautiful, beautiful. And this was one, I guess it's hard to say because the director's cut that you can get on DVD in the nice two disc DVD set kind of made the you know, and they redid it in what, like 2000 or 2001, made it so much prettier because it was very basic looking, very late 70s ish in terms of like long term, you know, long form shots, like when the shuttle is going into the Starfleet dock. And then they kind of added like stuff to the scene and everything. So there's no doubt that it had a grander look than the TV show because it had more money and a bigger screen for everybody to look at. The problem was that the concept of a scene on television is fine. But when you take the same thematic concept and try to put it in a movie, now you got a problem, because I think Gene kind of, like, his eyes are bigger than his stomach kind of thing when you're looking at food. I think he realized, wow, we could make this even bigger and grander, and instead it was dull. I understand, you know, the bright lights and the flashing and the very low music, and they're all just staring and staring. And I remember I walked over to your desk and I said, I think I've heard three lines in 18 minutes. All I've heard is, boom. We'll talk about the music. That's the last category. But we're like, we'll talk about Jerry's music in a minute. That part was fine, but they're all just staring. Like, they're all hypnotized. Staring. Staring. And we're supposed to be hypnotized by this little tiny Enterprise and V'ger, this giant friggin' thing. But that would have been fine maybe in like 9 minutes. 18? Now you're pushing it a lot. So as much as the camera and I'm sure Robert Wise probably thought the same thing, but the visual looks amazing, but drawn out a lot. And I don't know if that hurts the overall package of the movie. Some people say it does. Your thoughts on that whole kind of Roddenberry thinking that kind of didn't translate the way he probably thought it would, and your overall thoughts and grade on the production value?
Well, when it comes to the stuff that just kind of lingers, I'm not sure how much of it is Gene's fault. I don't want to fault Robert Wise, the director.
No, I don't need to.
However, you know, this is the guy who directed like West Side Story and The Sound of Music, you know.
Yeah, I know.
So, but he also directed The Day the Earth Stood Still, so he's got some sci-fi cred. But I've always seen, now I don't know if this is, well, all right. I've always seen this movie as kind of a response to 2001 A Space Odyssey in terms of, you know, that style of sci-fi filmmaking. Here's some shots of spaceships and, you know, space stations, whatever, we're just going to linger on this for a while and show you how pretty it is. Now, I kind of, if anyone gets the blame, I guess it could be Douglas Trumbull, who the special effects guy, because he worked on 2001. So I'm sure he wanted to have his models and special effects get as much attention as they did then. However, yes, there are plenty of scenes where the art department special effects guys, they are just marveling at what they've created at the expense of the pace of the movie. Like you said, there is that entire scene where the Enterprise is flying through the outer cloud before they reach the actual V'ger spaceship. And yeah, it's just minute after minute after minute of reaction shot from, you know, George Takei or Bill Shatner, whoever, with flashing lights on them. And then, you know, the reverse angle is, you know, these amazing, you know, artist renderings of what will this cloud look like, these trippy corridors and, you know, lighting effects and everything. Again, Doug Trumbull's stuff. And yeah, in a small, relatively well-paced dose, that would have been really cool. You know, oh, it's so alien. Oh, it's so spectacular. And then you find yourself looking at your watch going, oh, we're still going. Okay. Yeah. And yeah, there's, you know, one or two lines of dialogue that breaks it up, but then it just keeps going. And it's just, it's drawn out. It's definitely drawn out. But in terms of the overall production, it's a slippery slope, in terms of how I look at it. yes, you have your big screen opportunity. So yeah, you're going to showcase the hell out of all this, you know, your Enterprise model and your new fancy sets and everything. However, those sets are stark. There is no color in this movie. All the color from the original series, you know, gold, blue, and red uniforms, you know, colored beams and doors and corridors on the Enterprise, you know, there was color everywhere. It was 1966, you know, you were just going to blast your viewers on, you know, their color TV. So here you have white corridors. Looks like you're walking through a hospital. But the the worst offender is the costumes. The Starfleet uniforms.
I was waiting for you to. I was kind of tossing that softball to you because I knew we were going to get to it.
Yeah, you knew this was coming. The Starfleet uniforms in this movie are a travesty. They are one of three colors: white, grayish blue, or mustard yellow.
The yellow is awful too.
Yeah,
I mean it's
less
awful.
Than flattering on everybody. The only uniform that looks halfway decent is the one that Kirk wears kind of midway through the movie, where it's this like white short sleeve tunic.
Yeah, it looks like he was at the gym.
Yeah, exactly. He's ditched the, you know, the grayish blue pajamas, all of which have this belt buckle, which is completely pointless. Yeah, it's just this giant black plastic belt. Yeah, that they retcon and say, oh, it's some sort of like life support monitoring device. Yeah, all right, whatever, you know. But it's just apparently Robert Wise told the costume department to tone it down because he didn't want to distract from the actors' faces. Well, mission accomplished, because that's the only thing that's showing any signs of life on the sets, and even that's saying something when they're staring at the screen for, you know, 8-9 minutes. But you know, that's the downside. You know, the Enterprise looks like a hospital. The uniforms are terrible. But at the same time, yeah, you get this fantastic new Enterprise model, which in the con category, you get about 4 or 5 straight minutes of just beauty shots when they're approaching. The only saving grace there is Jerry Goldsmith. We'll get to that. Even in the beginning, you know, the Klingons are approaching. Like, oh, the Klingons, these are the nasty bad guys. Klingon ships, they look really pretty. But they're just coming at you really slow.
Very slow.
The Klingon bridge looks amazing, but nothing's happening there. There's just a bunch of Klingons sitting around. The captain is barking orders. That's about it. You know, you've got shots of the Epsilon 9 space station. Again, here's a space station. We're still looking at the space station. What's going on inside? Oh, okay, we're finally inside the space station. Yeah. But you know, then you cut to the end of the movie and yeah, you have a really cool set piece at the end. You know, the actual Voyager space probe is there, you know, in this, you know, kind of electronic crater with lights pulsing and everything. So that looked pretty cool. So not to say they didn't do a good job on designing definitely certain parts of the movie. But yeah, there's so much lacking in terms of there's no life aboard the Enterprise, which is so ironic. Considering that they're out there looking for life.
Yep.
Yeah, it's just this cold Spartan sets.
Mm.
But yes, the bridge is prettier because it's bigger, a little bit more dynamic. But yeah, they'd fix that in later movies.
Yes, they would. Yes, they would. So how would you grade it? All the whole
production
pack.
Design, well, the models are great. Costumes suck. Enterprise sets are kind of dreary. I'll give it a 5.
5. Okay. And finally, and I think this might be next to the cast, the best grade of the movie, the music, because you mentioned the Trek equivalent of John Williams, and that is, of course, Jerry Goldsmith. Jerry thinks differently, of course, than John. We're not comparing their types. I mean, they're very different composers. But Jerry is the sound of Trek. I think we've always established that. But you are saved from the long camera shots of like, Scotty, can you hit the gas on the damn shuttle? Jesus, why does it feel like the thing's an idol? But Jerry's the music Jerry uses as we're looking at the Enterprise is pretty damn impressive. Same with the 18-minute staring at, you know, the flashing lights and as the ship eats the ship pretty much. Jerry kind of saves us from literally falling asleep. Jerry Goldsmith's got an amazing resume. I don't think we have to mention it here. Again, similar to John Williams. That damn good. How's he work for you?
Oh, my God. Goldsmith. The man was amazing. I miss him terribly. We lost Jerry back in the early 2000s. Yes, he is the saving grace for so many of the flyby shots of this movie where there is absolutely zero dialogue and very little going on screen in terms of action. Most notably, of course, is the approach to the Enterprise. It's a 6-minute scene with no dialogue. Nope. It is just Kirk and Scotty in the shuttle approaching the Enterprise. The piece is fantastic. It is an absolute beautiful piece of music. You know, it's a slow build as they're approaching, you know, and it's reflected visually on screen as you see pieces of the Enterprise through the space dock exterior. And then they come around that big grandiose U-turn. And then as soon as Kirk sees the Enterprise head on, Jerry Goldsmith just blasts you with the theme that he's written for this movie, which, of course, would go on to be the not only his theme for all subsequent movies he would score, but the theme for Star Trek: The Next Generation. But yeah, that scene it makes that scene watchable because you could just listen and bask in the glory of Goldsmith. But yeah, the stuff he uses for the rest of the score is so unique because every time you see the cloud, it makes that like boom sound, which, yeah. You know, is, you know, 40 years ahead of Hans Zimmer. This, of course, was the it's the blaster beam. I'm pretty sure is the name of it. It's this long, like, I don't know, like sheet metal thing. And you had to, like, I think Goldsmith said he had to hit it with like old artillery shells. And that's what gave it that resonating metallic sound. It's so unique and so alien. So it works for the movie, you know, just kind of whacks you. And it's nothing mm-hmm. you've ever heard before or since.
Right.
But everything, I feel like just, you know, the flybys are just saved by his, you know, his horns and his strings. And I can never say enough good things about Jerry Goldsmith. And, you know, we'll clearly be talking about him down the line as well, but, you know, all the way until the end with, you know, the merging at the end. And of course, Ilya's theme, this movie has an overture in front of it. You know,
yes,
you put your DVD in and it just starts with a starfield and this beautiful piece of music. It's Ilya's theme is the official title of it, you know, the character from the movie. And, you know, Jerry would refer to it as the love theme casually. But it's this beautiful piece that, of course, goes in and out of the movie with her and Decker and all that. So right there, you start with Jerry Goldsmith. And then that piece ends, and then, you know, the opening title comes up. It's just bum bum ba da da da. You know, the Star Trek theme kicks in. You're like, oh, okay, Jerry Goldsmith's gonna knock me in the face here. Let's do this.
Yeah.
So yeah, beginning to and then of course you follow the theme with the Klingon theme, which is, in my opinion, one of the, and this is saying something, one of the greatest things Jerry Goldsmith has ever written. You know. Yeah, I mean, and of course, he used every opportunity to bring that back in subsequent movies. But yeah, all that stuff. Fantastic. Yeah, so alien, so cool. I'm just going to go ahead and say it. Jerry Goldsmith gets a 10 on this one. He just knocks it out.
Yeah, he really does. He really does. And I'm going to have a lot to say about, and this is one thing that I will always say, about the franchise, comparing Trek and Wars in terms of franchises, the music, and not to pull the curtain too far, but as we know, John Williams did all 9 movies, 11, I guess. Jerry did not do all 10 Treks, and
no,
he
only did 5 of them.
That always bugs me. I don't know why they just didn't bring him back every time. It makes no sense. Anyway, all right, so our final grade, 8. 17, 21, 26, 36 out of 50 is our final grade for Star Trek: The Motion Picture. We are also going to talk about the posters, because the posters always have, you know, this back in the day when we had these amazing painted posters, which you just do not see anymore, which, well, except for maybe the Star Wars movies had them. Potters did too, I guess. I guess Harry Potter movie posters are usually artwork.
First one's definitely a Drew Struzan.
Yeah, Drew Struzan's amazing, and he's one of many. He's one of a couple of tremendous movie poster artists that are just amazing. I love the poster for Star Trek: The Motion Picture. And you know what's great about it too, Tech, is when you look at the poster. I remember looking at it in the theater when I was six, and I asked my dad. We went to go see something that summer, and that poster, you know, the cover of the DVD, was at the showcase in Orange, where I went. And I said, "Dad, you know, I recognize Kirk and I recognize Spock, and who's in the middle is Ilea." And you're like, "Who the hell's that?" I didn't say, "Who the hell's that?" I was six. I'm like, "Dad, who's that?" And my dad's like, "I have no idea." So the fact that we're getting this Star Trek movie, and on top of the fact you have the two big guys, you have Kirk and Spock, and then you have this character that no one ever heard of on the poster in the middle.
Yeah, lends that air of mystery. Like, really? Who's this?
Yeah, I think
who's
that's
this
amazing.
Joining the crew? Yeah.
I have always said that took a lot of guts to put on the poster, not just Shat and Leonard, but this person. That who the hell is this bald? And obviously you could tell it was a woman. You're like, there's a bald woman on the front of the poster. What the hell are we doing here? It's very strange. Where's Bones? But the poster's amazing. So kudos always to Drew Struzan for that one. It'll be the first of what will be many of my favorite movie posters, because one thing knocks it out of the park.
If Drew Struzan didn't do that poster, who did do the Star Trek motion picture poster? Sorry, I mentioned his name. Right. I was talking about Harry Potter. Sorry.
You're absolutely right. I brain farted on that.
Bob Peake.
Yeah. I'm sorry. Yeah, you're right. Bob Peake.
Yeah. It's a brilliant piece, because it's so cool that you have the three faces there, you know, in that shaft of color that, you know, covers the spectrum. And what's really cool about it is how you have Kirk in pretty much all red, which makes you wonder, like, oh, that's kind of just a visual cue, like, oh, what's going on with Kirk, you know? And then Ilea's in yellow, which is not really the center of the spectrum, but then the green and blue is on Spock, which I don't know if this was Bob Peake's intention, but that kind of hints at the two Spocks we get in the movie, how he kind of transitions from one to the other. So it's really cool. There's a lot going on in that poster for a very simple design.
Sadly, unlike Drew Struzan, who is still with us, Bob Peake sadly passed away in 1992 at the age of 65. He was older than Drew Struzan. We will, not the last that you and I will be gushing over Bob Peake. Besides the first six treks, because he does every poster, which is why I like most of them. He also did during that time. He did Superman, the movie. So the year before, he did that awesome poster of the clouds and that red, white, and blue, or the red, white, red, yellow, and blue stripe, you know, kind of
streak
with that awesome. And I've always loved it. Not that we're going off the path on this, but this might be another series down the line. The silver S, and he did that one. He also did, the poster for, Apocalypse Now. So if you've ever seen the Apocalypse Now poster, my God, is that amazing. And, he also did the poster for Excalibur, which might be the only thing in the history of that movie that doesn't have boobs on it. By the way, he also did The Spy Who Loved Me and a few other Bond films. So yep. Bob Peake, God rest his soul, tremendous movie poster illustrator in the same realm as Drew Struzan. They're both amazing. Now, as for wanting to own Star Trek the Motion Picture, and you know me, I love talking physical media. There is the Blu-ray set that's out right now. It's a white box. It's called the Stardate Collection. That has all 10 movies and two bonus discs. But that version of Star Trek... Now, I would recommend buying that anyway, because it's Blu-ray and it looks gorgeous. However, and we'll talk about this in our next episode too, the first two Star Trek movies, that set only has the theatrical versions. So you want to go back and find the pretty awesome looking two-disc thick DVD sets, which I love, as Tech knows very well, because he owns them too. So I actually bought, I retro, it's the only time I've ever double dipped on anything. Well, not anything, but something this big. I actually bought the 10 DVD box set that came out in, well, this is the re-release, because my boxes are different than yours. I think mine came out like in, I don't know, 05 probably, 6. You bought them individually, right, as
they came out? Yeah, as they were released, they started it. I think, I'm pretty sure it was 01. Robert Wise released the director's cut of Motion Picture. And everyone would come out after that in the silver boxes, and I just snatched them up.
And then I got them. I bought this on eBay, but I think it came out with a box set, with a box. And the Motion Picture box is gold. The other nine, as Tech mentioned, are all silver. But so if you want a good-looking movie, you can watch the director's cut. You can watch the theatrical cut. However, I recommend, as does Tech, find the DVD version of the director's cut because it's a better movie.
100%.
And the best part about the DVDs, the special features are through the roof. I mean, they load these suckers up. And I'm pretty sure that they're all the same on the Blu-ray set, too. I think they just carried those over. As a matter of fact, I can almost guarantee they did. It's just featurettes and the story and the backstory and everything. It's an amazing set. So highly recommend getting the Blu-ray set. But at least for these first two movies, and we'll talk about this again in the next episode, find the DVD version of this one. The two-disc gold case, because it's the director's cut. It's a better version. So, all right. 36 out of 50, our final grade. One down, nine to go. Tech, great job. That was fantastic.
Thank you very much.
And get your vocal cords ready, because you'll be doing that much talking for the next nine episodes. So, for the next nine chapters. So, where could everyone find you? I made you do this five times the first time.
Oh yeah. Well, if you are so inclined, you can follow me on Instagram at Technicolor T3KNIKOLOR or on Twitter at Hal Dameron, combining my two favorite fictional pilots, Hal Jordan and Poe Dameron, HALDAMERON. That's really it for me on social media.
Okay.
Or you can connect with me on Skype if you want, like we are right now at Tech715, TEK715.
Absolutely. You can, of course, follow me on Twitter at PTBPodfather. Of course, follow the networks, the site, the family, at Place to Be Nation on Twitter. Follow us, the great shows here on the Pop feed, great shows on our other feed, the Place to Be Wrestling Network, great shows there. Don't forget to follow our other sister and brother feeds, the Jenny Position and the North-South Podcast Connection. We'll be back with, we're not sure how we're scheduling these. You're listening to this now, so we know it aired on someday, but, our next episode, we fast forward 3 years, bring back an old friend of James Tiberius Kirk for what could be our first legitimate contender for the best Star Trek movie of all time. He's Tech. I'm Scott. Hop in the Enterprise. Take off the dopey belt buckle. We'll talk to you next time.
Live long and prosper.
In 18 minutes.